we get the second hour underway, like we do every Tuesday, by welcoming back into the program writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, Mr. Kimball?
Not too bad, thank you. How's your day been so far? Have you brought the monument to its collective concrete knees?
It's granitic knees.
Ah, yes,
and
yes.
I did climb it 5 times, and right now I am in Memorial Hall out at Harvard. I am field tripping with my little friend Emma. We have just gone to the Harvard Art Museums, and we are going to an anime screening at the Brattle.
Excellent. Good stuff there. We're going to talk about Orson Welles, so we'll get to that because I want to hear more about you seeing a new take. Well, not a new take, an old take, but first time type of take on Citizen Kane. But we want to talk about some of the similarities today between Orson Welles and the Beatles, right?
Yes. I think what you get with any truly great artist is a body of work that is not confined or even most about the official great works of art. Do you know what I mean by that? So, like, we zero in on Revolver for the Beatles. We zero in on Citizen Kane, of course, for Orson Welles. And I think, though, what you get with the best artists is this sort of person who never leaves off in the creation of art. In other words, it's not banal, but it's daily. And it comes out in things that we might not formally look at is art. And I find those things often as potent as art and more telling, in fact, about the artist.
So if we talk about the Beatles, where's a good place to start to see this in practice?
If you were in the Beatles and you were turning up at the BBC just to cut a radio session, you would be looking at that as fulfilling a contractual obligation. They would turn up and they would field requests to cover Johnny B. Goode or Soldier of Love by Arthur Alexander or Buddy Holly song, Jerry Lewis, Eddie Cochran, all of that. And I think what we end up with are recordings that are more emblematic of the spirit and the range of the Beatles as performers, as singers, as songwriters, than you would get with the classic run of Rubber Soul, Revolver, Pepper. I find that those BBC air shots are more revealing of who they were as artists than that trilogy of albums.
Yeah, we've talked about that with you a little bit before, and that the energy that they brought to those live performances, that wasn't always captured with the sometimes obsessive nature of their studio albums.
I don't even think it's necessarily a question of rough edges being shaved away or anything like that. I just think when you're truly the best at what you do, you can't help but have it come out, that there's no respite. It's like if you're a fish, you breathe in the water. If you're a monkey, you're up in the land, you breathe on terra firma. If you're an artist, you always breathe in whatever medium you happen to be working in at the time. It's not like, oh, I'm turning it on right now, let's do this. And I think that's why I'm drawn to artists like this, because it was something I always was able to pinpoint with myself. You've seen enough of it. If I'm writing you a letter, if I'm posting something on the blog, it's not really that artistically qualitatively different than the official story, the book, whatever it may be. Because I think the better you are at art, the less likely you are to have this kind of like official moment. And then, okay, the rest of the time I'm just walking around as some scrub. No, you're always that reflexive artist. It's a part of who you are. It's as basic to who you are as breathing is to other people.
Well, I'm interested in what you think of the Beatles as individuals. Did they continue that approach into their solo work?
No. I think it's tremendously sad in some ways. And it limits them. It limits their legacy. These are people who did next to nothing in life once they got out of their 20s. I mean, they did whatever they did in their private lives, but there's nothing that's going to last from those solo careers. It's all within that 7-year period of when they were commercially, as we know them, the Beatles. The rest of it's fluff. It's difficult. It doesn't really add up to anything. And I listen to something even like Imagine, and I hear how insincere that is. And John Lennon, I should preface this by saying, he's my favorite musician. I would rather listen to him sing or listen to one of his songs than anyone else's. And when we talk about John Lennon, we can also talk about Orson Welles, and that they could both be horrible to other people. And Welles would normally do it because he felt insecure about his acting prowess, or he was humiliated that he had to act in someone else's film who wasn't nearly the director he was. And also, it can be very straining to get along with other people. And he could be cruel to people that way. But John Lennon, the more you learn about John Lennon, he just was a bad person. As much as I like him as my favorite musician, this was someone who was almost nonstop cruel to people, to his wife, Cynthia, the things that he did, making fun of people with disabilities, but he was just mean in his relationships. And I think that's kind of a demerit, too, because I see a lot of that that was carried forward after the Beatles were done. I think, really, his saving grace was what he did within the confines of that band. And once that band was no more, there wasn't a lot to really recommend this guy as a person.
But it seemed like he did change, certainly with the birth of his son, Sean, in those last 4 or 5 years of his life. I don't know that he made amends for things that he'd done in his past, but he seemed to become a better person.
No, I don't think so. I think
No?
It was a lot of lip service. I think he knew what to say. When he was doing the whole feminism thing, you have to realize he was beating the tar out of Yoko Ono, cheating on her. So he was paying lip service to a lot of things. And that's why I think his anthemic songs, Your Imagines, Your All You Need Is Love, they have such a kind of, it's like those Easter candies, the big rabbits, and you tap your finger against them and they're hollow. I think they're almost like the song version of that. When he was more splenetic, he was more effective rhythmically. And when he was more introspective and questioning who he was, Strawberry Fields Forever, In My Life, he wrote better. But no, I've been steeped in this man's world and in his art for the majority of my life. And there isn't a source I haven't turned over. And I just don't see any kind of really redeeming decency in him as a human.
Now, we've talked about this before, separating art from artist and judging people from 100 years ago, 75 years ago, or 50 years ago by contemporary standards. If we use that lens, does it change your view of Lennon?
No, and I never subscribed to any of that anyway, because like the people now who, so you asked me about the monument, there's a statue outside the monument of William Prescott. And William Prescott was this guy who obviously was lionized, if he has a statue for him at this Battle of Bunker Hill, but he showed up at the wrong place. He caused them basically to have this horrible defeat, this Pyrrhic victory, I guess, retrospectively, but it wasn't like a good day for our side, essentially. And I thought, you know what? Someone could dig into this guy's life and they could find something. And this statue would have to come down, whether he had slaves or whatever it was. And yet the same people who would have that attitude right now were the people who were doing Jack, you know what, 5 years ago, because they have always gone along with the masses as well. There was never anyone who's all about these movements now who was doing it on their own 5 years ago. And it could be a different thing. So I put absolutely no stock in that whatsoever. It's just a matter of whatever is the broad movement at the time that advances your ego / power cause that people align themselves with. So I dismiss all of that. I don't think anyone would have bucked any trends because most people, very few people, you know this. Think about how many you've known in your life. Go against trends and say, you know what? No, I'm standing up for this. And if you won't stand up with me, I'm standing up nonetheless. That's Socrates. That's a very rare person.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. When we talk about Welles, the conversation begins, obviously, with Citizen Kane. Let's first talk about the experience you had. Was it at the Brattle this weekend that you saw it in the 35mm presentation?
Yes, it was the first time I've ever seen it on the big screen, and it was, like you said, in 35mm. And I think there is this idea with Welles that he's intimidating to people. I have a longtime family friend, and she does not like Citizen Kane. And I wonder if she's ever even tried to sit through it. She likes The Stranger, which is just kind of a quickie Nazi, Noir-esque whodunit, really, in a small Connecticut town in an attempt by Welles to make some money. It was the only picture he did that turned a profit. But I think people are intimidated by his mind. Welles was a Michelangelo. He was someone who, he probably was smarter than Michelangelo, I think. When you really get into his entire corpus of work, it's huge. And you're a Wells person, and I bet you I could point out things by Wells that even you have never heard of, because he was that voluminous in terms of what he created. So you always get the sense with him that he's clinical, that it's cold, right? That it's sort of like cold steel you're touching. And Citizen Kane is a very human picture. It's very moving. I wept throughout it. And at the end, it was part of that were tears of gratitude. It's like, oh, okay, that's someone. That's like a brother to me. And it makes me feel less alone. But as a picture, it's wonderfully cagey and aware. And the scenes where he smashes up, for instance, Susan Alexander's room after she leaves him, that is so visceral. Find me a more emotional scene than that. And it's funny. His first line, of course, is Rosebud. But after that, his actual first, like, full sentence is this kind of in-joke of, hey, don't believe everything you hear on the radio.
Right.
He's referencing the War of the Worlds broadcast, right? Because that's how people knew him. It's like, ah, you sly boots having some fun with us.
Did he lose, from your perspective, any of that artistry after he lost creative control and found himself making movies that, in some cases, like Magnificent Ambersons, other people would then go in and re-edit?
I don't think he lost any of his chops, let's put it that way. But he was hated by an entire system and an entire industry. And you can understand, too, why, with what you know I'm going through, why that resonates with me. These people would not let him make his work. And he had to make his work on the cheap. He had to blag his way into whatever funds he could get. It was all by hook or by crook, whatever he could do, because he lived in service to that art. And at the same time he's making the films, he's writing one of our great American plays, which nobody knows, Moby Dick rehearsed. He's creating art constantly on the radio. He's doing things on the radio that people are not even aware of now. He played, for instance, Professor Moriarty. Nobody knows that. And he was one of the best Moriartys ever.
And he was Lamont Cranston also.
Right. That was in the late 30s, basically before he had his Hollywood run at all. And he didn't write those shows, but he had, look, there's certain keys to radio. It's one of those things that everyone thinks they can do, and then you go to do it, and you can't do it. It's a number of things. It's the quality of your voice, the actual timbre of your voice. It's how quickly you can anticipate things, how quickly you can create and think and envision what's going to come next before something else has come to pass. It's your energy. Energy is a huge, I'd say that's the number one thing about radio. That doesn't mean you scream or whatever. You can be in perfect control. But you have energy, and Wells was at his best when he was putting his sizable energy to use. And there were stories that he'd stay up for 3 days, and he's drinking brandy and pots of coffee, and no one could keep up with him. He was this positive maelstrom, but everyone comes back to Kane. I don't think Kane is the picture that Chimes at Midnight is, and you have these examples throughout his career where it's like, this guy, he's evolving. He's getting better. And so I think Kane was a start, and it looks and you have these British rock bands, for instance, and they're just getting going in 1963, 1964. Their sound would be anemic because of the quality of the British recording studio. The American sound was so much boomier and bassier because they had the better equipment. It was that simple. Wells had the better equipment once, and then it was taken from him. And then it was like, uh-oh, what am I going to do to paste this together? And his work would work despite its technical limitations, the budgetary limitations.
Well, that makes me think of one of my favorite films, and in many ways it's a mess, but it's the sheer power of his personality and his talent that makes me love F for Fake as much as I do.
F for Fake is a strange film, and it's a film where, well, I shouldn't say that. That's kind of uncharitable to it, because when you watch it, it's not strange. It's not strange at all. What I should have said is that it's not precedented, right?
Right.
Where we're in this society now where I think people want fresh things. They want new things. That's what they respond to. That's what they always have. Wizard of Oz, Star Wars, the early Disney cartoons, 1937. That's what people go for. The Beatles. And yet, the people in charge of decisions often look for retreads. And they want something that's, oh, it's this thing we've seen 100 times crossed with this thing we've seen 100 times. Nobody wants it. nobody buys it, and then people bemoan and they blame Netflix or whatever else for the problems of their industry. F for Fake was singular. There was nothing like it. And Welles was always obsessed with, in his private life, being a magician. Like, you would get these magician magazines and cut out the things at the back, like spend $4.99 and get like a book of tricks. He did that. He did that all the time. He was a member of all these magician societies. That and pulp novels. He traveled around with a giant case. Like, it was huge. It was a treasure chest of just dime store pulp novels. And when I say that to you, like, it makes sense when you think about his stories, how much he loved an actual story. They're not these clinical, like, watch me move the camera type of things. They're full-blown, what happens next, I need to know type of stories. So I think he was just so full, well-rounded, and there was really nothing he couldn't do. And sometimes even just his interviews were art, or his book he did with Peter Bogdanovich. As a work of philosophy, I'm sorry, you can put that up there with anything Plato did. You can read that. I read that all the time. And it's like, wow, this is one of the big boy books of my entire reading history.
Colin, before we let you go, you shared some thoughts on social media today about the Hockey Hall of Fame. Do you want to go over those briefly?
Yes. Do you? I don't know what's happened yet, but I know that Kaylee Wickenhauser will get in, should get in, the most obvious candidate, best female hockey player ever. So good that she was like a cusp NHL player. That's amazing. That's not like, oh, he's being sexist, he's throwing a bone. No, that's just like impossibility, right? And she was that talented. Tom Barrasso should have been in a long time ago. Vladimir Krutov, the Soviet forward, was, I would have said, for the 1980s, one of your top five hockey players in the world, the second best player in the Soviet Union behind Sergei Makarov. And I think Doug Wilson should be in. If Borje Salming's in, I don't really understand why Doug Wilson is not in. And there was one other I mentioned. Oh, Theo Fleury, big game player, great stats, great point per game average. But I think they're going to put in Daniel Alfredson, and that's going to bother me because he was a B-plus player and never any more than that.
Yeah, I haven't seen the official announcement. I think it was supposed to come out sometime around 4:30 or 5 o'clock.
And Curtis Joseph, who just played for a long time as a goalie, racked up a lot of wins, never won anything, didn't win a Vezina or anything like that. I would put in someone like Tim Thomas. Tim Thomas is the hockey version of a poor man, Sandy Koufax, right? He doesn't have, like, where he was for 5 or 6 years, he was the absolute best. But for two of those years, he was the best. And as we just watched with the Bruins, as good as Tuukka Rask was throughout the playoffs, Tim Thomas was, you see the difference between Rask and Thomas. There was no way Thomas would have lost that game 7, right? He would have found a way, if he had to bite somebody in the throat, to win that game. That just would not have happened. It's not a skill thing. It's not a technique thing. It's a balls as big as grapefruit thing, as a hockey coach of mine used to say. And he had that. He was a fierce competitor, and I'd have no problem with him going in. Or Tim Kerr. Tim Kerr had like 58 goals 4 years in a row. That's outrageous.
Colin Fleming talking with us here on Downtown. Get his new book. It's so great, Buried on the Beaches. Check out his work on the website, ColinFlemingLit.com. And, of course, join him every Tuesday right here on Downtown. Thank you, Colin.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, taking his little 15-year-old neighbor to the museum and to the anime. Come on, buy the book.
Buy the book. You'll love it.